You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Adam Langer, the Forward's senior editor for culture and the author of the new novel, Cyclorama. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcast, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Today we begin the Jewish calendar month of Elul, last month of the year, when we prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish days of awe, the High Holy Days. They start 4 weeks from tonight with Rosh Hashanah, Sunday night, September 25th, and of course the 26th for the first day. The word Elul, the name of this month, is made up of four Hebrew letters, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. In a beautiful interpretation from Midrash, these four letters stand for the words Ani Ledodi Vedodi Li. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. That's a passage from the beautiful biblical book, The Song of Songs, which teaches that at this time of year, God seeks to unify with us, to renew the bonds of love and tenderness that come during this period of return and renewal. To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar every day of this month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, and of course to apologize to all of those we have wronged or injured. Blowing shofar is a great way to, well, wake everybody up. A shofar is a ram's horn, hollowed out. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own, and with a bit of practice, you too can blow shofar. Our school children in our congregation Beit Simcha Religious School are all making shofars this year, and they'll learn how to blow them. You can too. It's a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days, an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. This morning is actually Rosh Chodesh Elul, the special celebratory day of the beginning of this Jewish month, so it's especially appropriate to get us going in this season of tshuva just the right way. Of course, following a true Jewish tradition, I brought a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us in for this show. Well, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you surely should be now. Now, those shofar calls are divided into three separate, well, kind of four separate, but related blasts. Each has a name and a unique sound. Tekiah, the first blast, is a two-note solid call. If you're a fancy shofar blower, you can add a little topper at the end to make it three notes. Shevarim means literally a broken call. That's the three-part up-and-down sounding shofar blast. Teruah is a staccato series of nine sharp blasts. It was likely a kind of military or alarm call in ancient times. And then finally the Tekiah Gedola is a two-note solid blast held as long as you can. There are, of course, different traditions on just how long is appropriate. I usually shoot for as long as my breath holds out, except here on Two Jewish, where we pay for airtime and it is uniquely valuable. Anyway, the combination of shofar calls is supposed to awaken our souls, bring us towards commitment and connection with God. return us to acts of repentance, prayer, and charity. And for a solid month, we hear these shofar calls every day. Not a bad way to bring ourselves towards holiness during this coming sacred season. Play us in this morning a little more elegantly on the same theme of the shofar. We begin with a setting of a classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tekah B'Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty, gathering our exiles from the four corners of the earth to return, perhaps even to return to temple for services on Rosh Hashanah in a month. This is a highly idiosyncratic version by the Diaspora Collection Yeshiva Band, kind of a countrified setting that you will definitely not hear in our synagogue, at least this year. That was Tekah B'Shofar for the coming High Holy Days and the season of the shofar, as it might be performed in North Carolina or Tennessee from the Diaspora Collection Yeshiva Band. Our guest this morning, Adam Langer, is one of my favorite novelists, the Forward Senior Editor for Culture, author of an excellent new novel, Cyclorama, Hard to Put Down, which, by the way, uses a famous Jewish play for its setting. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Adam Langer is one of my favorite novelists of all time, author of Crossing California, The Washington Story, Ellington Boulevard, and many others. He is the Forward's Senior Editor for Culture, which I'm curious what that means, but I definitely want to know, and the author of the new book, Cyclorama, another terrific novel. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having me, Rabbi. Appreciate being here, even if I'm some distance away from Tucson.
Yes, indeed. You should be here. It's although I don't think this is the best month for us. Come in February when it's miserable everywhere else and great here.
Minor league baseball, spring training, that sort of thing.
Yeah, all of that stuff. We're good at that. And actually hiking. And, you know, it's great here till it gets hot, which, you know, it's only 6 months, so not so much. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of Cyclorama.
Well, the novel, I guess I should introduce the subject of it for your listeners who don't know it yet or don't feel like Googling madly as they listen to us talk. But The story is of a group of teenagers in North Suburban Chicago in the early 1980s who meet to perform in a production of The Diary of Anne Frank. And the production goes on to traumatize them in various ways. And it tells about their experiences doing the play as teenagers in 1982, and then whoosh, it flashes forward to 2016, the beginning of the Trump era, and revisits all the characters and shows how the looming shadow of this high school production continues to affect them 30-odd years later. The story is told from the perspective of each of the characters that is in the play, The Diary of Anne Frank. That means Otto Frank, Anne Frank, and the people they live with, et cetera, et cetera. It's told from 10 different perspectives, both in 1982.
The Van Dams, the whole thing, that's right.
Right, 2016, 2017. And how I came to write it, talking about how you write a book is a funny thing, because I could talk about 5 or 10 or 20 different inspirations. They'd all be different, and they'd all be kind of true. But what I think inspired me to write it was looking at the beginning of the dawn of the Trump era, the dawn of Me Too, and all these stories that were beginning to come out. And there were a lot of people who were looking at these stories that were coming out in 2016, 17, 18, and thinking that they had come out of nowhere, these stories of adolescent trauma. And what I wanted to do is look back and see how a lot of the seeds for what happened in the early part of the Trump era were actually planted, you know, when people in my generation were kids, were teenagers. So on the one hand, half of the novel is set in 1982, and it's very precisely set there. But at the same time, to me, it's a novel about our current political moment and how we got there. So 2016-17 was very much on my mind, but I kind of felt I needed to go back to 1982
to explain how we got to where we got to. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to admit that my son played Otto Frank in a high school production of The Diary of Anne Frank, and I have that photo as my screensaver on my phone. So this book hit home in some very interesting ways. We will talk much more with Adam Langer about Cyclorama and about all of his work when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. The Jewish High Holy Days are coming. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, fabulous Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Come in person. Call 520-276-5675. 276-5675. Religious school has begun for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us. Our fabulous Hebrew school and bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. For Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, members and guests are warmly welcomed in our sanctuary, but of course they can also attend online. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night or Saturday morning, or of course on the High Holy Days. You can email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us Friday night on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, also has lots of other great information about our congregation. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and they are legion, are live and on Zoom. You can come to a pre-high holiday seminar with me. Access those through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our fantastic religious school, by the way, is available in blended format, too. Most students live, but some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, the High Holy Days, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. As a little musical bonus this morning, here's a setting from the Orthodox folk rock group Zusha, lovely recording of Gershon Albert's Melody of Thanksgiving, Nigun Hoda'ah. That was Zusha playing and singing Nigun Hoda'ah. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 175,000 downloads on Podbean and now available on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments are helpful. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You were recently in the south of France. That Jewish community around Carpentras, which we talked about last time, and some of those other hill towns formed a very interesting and important Jewish community, particularly in the Middle Ages, but it goes all the way back to Roman times. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Although, as far as I know, it's not continuous. It does go back to Roman times, but there was kind of an interregnum France was first taken over by the barbarians
Goths
and whatever.
Or whichever and tribe was.
Roman rule disappeared, and eventually.
The Jews left, they went somewhere else.
And nothing really happened until after Charlemagne came to the throne.
The Carolingian
in the year 800.
Empire period, right.
So, 800-ish. You know, under Clovis, there weren't really any Jewish communities, as far as we know, in that part of France. But in the Middle Ages, they were known as the Arba Kehilot Kedoshot, the four holy congregations. And it was Carpentras, Cavaillon, Avignon, and Lille-sur-la-Sorgue, which has no Jews left, but it does have a Jewish cemetery. The place we stayed for a whole week was Cavaillon. And there, a very beautiful, gem-like, truly unique synagogue has been transformed into a historic museum of the life of the Jews in the Comtat Venaissin, this region, this papal state. And they don't have so much of an exhibition as they do a visit to the sanctuary itself, which is unique, and I want to describe it in some detail because nobody's ever been in a shul like this. So first of all, there's a guide who's not Jewish but is extremely well-informed and well-educated and well-trained and knows all the right terms for everything in French, English, and Hebrew. Second of all, you climb up a steep staircase, of course, from the street through a gate that is opened by a key that's about 18 inches long and probably 800 years old. I mean, it's like the weirdest key I've ever seen. And she had like an armful of weird keys. I mean, she had 8 or 10 that probably weighed 25 pounds.
Not you can't run to the local locksmith and get a new key made there.
Right. So she brought us in through this gate and up this steep set of stairs into a tiny but beautiful sanctuary, which she explained was constructed partially with papal funds. So the Pope paid for this, and there were certain conditions attached, like Jews had to live essentially on that same street where the synagogue was, and there were gates at either end of the street, and they were locked in at night. This was their version of the ghetto. And at some points, it got very crowded and unhealthfully so, but not for very long, because Jews started to leave, or the draconian conditions were lifted, or whatever. I mean, things just changed. Went back into the synagogue. So you're in like the main sanctuary, which is tiny. And unlike any other sanctuary I've ever seen, there's lots of wood carvings, like just ornaments, not carvings of people or faces.
Torahs or Jewish symbols or something.
No, just like ornaments.
Okay.
Which are covered either by like bright blue paint or by gold leaf. So you don't generally see a lot of gilt in synagogues. Well, you do see guilt with a U, but not guilt, G-I-L-T.
You experience guilt. I don't know if you visualize it necessarily, but okay.
You
but
see a lot of people feeling guilt.
Gilded decoration. Wow.
Gilded lilies, as it were.
Uh-huh.
So then you look up to where you expect the women's section to be, right? Because there was separate seating. And you see like a small platform that was reserved for the Clay Kodesh, the rabbis, the cantors, the officers of the congregation, and could maybe fit 12 people if it were really crowded. And that's where the Torah was read from and the prayers were chanted from and the rabbi spoke from. So then you say, well, where did the women sit? And the guide says, wait, I'll show you. So you go back outside, down this steep flight of stairs, around the corner.
Oh my God.
To a door leading to a much larger room than the synagogue itself, which was not only the women's section, but also a mikveh and a communal baking oven, a Pesach matzah oven that was used by the community to bake matzah. And these were all in one room that was directly under the synagogue. So I asked the guide, I said, well, how did the women see what was going on? They didn't like see, they just heard. There were
really,
like
there
holes.
Wasn't even like, I've been to some where there's like a tiny little hole in the wall and you could hear or see.
No,
not even that.
There were holes to hear, but not to see because they were seated directly under the floor of the sanctuary.
Wow.
So that is unique in all my experience. I mean, it was a beautiful, tiny, gem-like little synagogue, but it was the least egalitarian treatment of women that I've ever seen at any synagogue in the world.
Well, fascinating. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is driving in Jerusalem. He's late for a meeting and looks desperately for a parking space, but can't find one. He finally turns his face upwards and says, "Oh Lord, if you find me a parking space, I promise I'll only eat kosher, I'll observe Shabbos, all the holidays, and give lots of money to charity, to tzedakah." Miraculously, a space suddenly opens up just in front of him. Moshe turns his face back upwards and says, "Never mind, God, I just found one." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Dvarim, Deuteronomy, is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice, and it includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice, justice, you must pursue. In the Torah, which has no kefel lashon, no extra words, a repetition of a word means it has additional importance and power. Here, the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just.
We must find a way to remove our own ego needs in any judging situation and seek not self-justification, but true justice. Sometimes we must even admit that our processes of justice can result in unjust decisions and unfair punishments. That, too, is part of seeking true justice, of being just. But even more than that, the Torah teaches that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase after it, make it a goal for ourselves and our own lives and civilization. It's not enough to act well at a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a more just one. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Each of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good and important in society. Without justice, there can be no peace. Without justice, there can be no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our leaders or our government to act well. Sometimes we need to be forcibly reminded that on many issues, injustice remains. We have to continue to work seriously to rectify this, and so to pursue justice. Be just, God commands, but never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Chase justice in your own life. Strive for justice in your organizations and institutions. Work for justice in your society. And only then will good truly follow. A great and holy message in a society like ours, in which the pursuit of happiness, or some weird idea, sometimes seems to be the ultimate goal in place of real justice. But the better pursuit, indeed, the most meaningful real pursuit for us, is justice. May our actions and our words help to make our society more just in this week, in this new month of Elul, in the coming new year of 5783, now just 4 weeks away from tonight. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Adam Langer, explains how he comes up with his intricately and beautifully connected plots and what the senior editor for culture at The Forward really does. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The U.S. military launched two airstrikes last week against terrorist groups linked to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in northeastern Syria, killing at least two guys. The strikes followed a failed rocket attacks on an American base this month. Iranian-backed terrorists launched two more the following week, one of which wounded three U.S. service members who were treated for minor injuries. This skirmish, well, I guess that's what you can call it, comes in the midst of talks between Iran and European diplomats hoping to renegotiate a deal that limits Iran's nuclear capabilities. The U.S. military airstrikes last week in eastern Syria were a message to Iran and Tehran-backed militias that have targeted American troops in the past month and several other times over the past year. Colin Cowell, the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, said that the U.S. airstrikes on facilities used by terrorist militias backed by Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard demonstrate that the U.S. will not hesitate to defend itself against Iranian and Iran-backed aggression when it occurs. He said the U.S. decision to launch these strikes was based on both the nature of Iranian-backed militia attacks at the Al-Tanf garrison, where U.S. troops are based in the south, and the fact that based on recovered drone parts, we believe we have Iran dead to rights on attribution. In other words, the Pentagon says Iran did it. The opposition war monitor, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and the activist collective Deir Ezor 24 said the airstrikes targeted the Ayash camp, run by the Fatimiyun group, made up of Shiite fighters from Afghanistan. The War Monitor reported that at least six Syrian and foreign terrorists were killed in the airstrikes. The other organization, Deir Ezzor 24, reported that there were 10. Deir Ezzor is a strategic province that borders Iraq and has oil fields. Iran-backed terrorist militia groups and Syrian forces control the area and have often been the target of Israeli warplanes in previous strikes. Call said that the U.S. strikes underscore that while the U.S. continues to pursue negotiations with Iran to resume its compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, those talks are not connected at all to America's willingness to take action when attacked. The threats that they engage in against our people in the region or elsewhere are not linked to wherever we end up on a nuclear deal, said Call. It actually has nothing to do with our willingness and resolve to defend ourselves. I think the strike was pretty clear communication to the Iranians that these things are on different tracks. Meanwhile, Israel and its prime minister and foreign minister tried hard to convince the U.S. that resuming the Iran nuclear deal was a bad idea. Prime Minister Yair Lapid said last week that the nuclear deal taking shape between Iran and world powers does not meet the standards set by President Joe Biden to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear state. Lapid said that if the agreement is signed as is, Israel would not be beholden by it. We will act to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power, he added. Lapid emphasized that removing sanctions will allow Iran to launder money to additional countries and create a direct path for funding terror. Israel's not opposed to every deal, Lapid said. We're just opposed to this deal because it's a bad deal, because we can't accept it the way it's written now. In principle, it does not meet the standards President Biden set. The current wording of the agreement is a bad deal, Lapid continued. It will give Iran $100 million a year, which will be put towards destabilizing the Middle East and spreading terror throughout the world. The money would go to strengthen the nuclear program and the same people who are trying to murder novelists and philosophers in New York, Lapid said, referring to the stabbing of writer Salman Rushdie, whom Iran has a considerable bounty on. We are holding an open dialogue with the U.S. government on all the issues in dispute, Lapid added. He recently discussed this deal with French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Meanwhile, Israeli Foreign Minister Benny Gantz visited Washington to stress these exact points with President Joe Biden, who has stressed American support for Israel. Well, we wish Benny Gantz luck, but more importantly, we continue to hope, pray, and encourage action so that Iran does not become a nuclear weapons power, which would be, well, horrible. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Adam Langer, who is In my book, one of the finest Jewish novelists working today, his new book is called Cyclorama, and it uses the device of a high school production of The Diary of Anne Frank to kind of explain, I don't know, how we got to a new autocratic era in America. Tell us a little bit about how you developed those personalities and how they changed for you.
Well, I mean, I approach writing from a very kind of improvisational sort of standpoint. I come from Chicago, which is kind of the epicenter of improvisational comedy. Not that this is a comedy necessarily, but the idea that you have, you know, you go to Second City, you go to a theater that does improv, they'll say you have two characters, they're in a bar, they're in this one place, go develop a story. And for me, it was very much that. A guy shows up at an audition for The Diary of Anne Frank. He's a kid in high school, and as a writer, you start asking questions. Who is this kid? Who are the people around him? Who's directing the show? And I approach the novel both as kind of an actor embodying each of these characters and trying to learn about them, and at the same time, on the outside, like a director directing their actions, trying to figure out, you know, it's very much like... peopling a novel is kind of like casting a show. You try and imagine this world of characters and who would play that role and why and how does that affect them. So it's very much a organic learning process where you have these characters and you try and figure out what their lives are like, what their emotional states are, what's important to them. And that way they become very, very human to me and hopefully human to the reader as well.
I have this strange feeling in novels that a lot of times people have no idea how to finish them these days. You can be reading a great novel, really terrific, really enjoying it, and then, I don't know, they just don't know how to finish a book. I think you do. And somehow you find a way to like kind of bring it all together. Is that intentional?
I mean, I like novels that have that end well, that aren't indeterminate, that don't give you the feeling that you just described of, wow, that was a great setup and I feel really let down. I think part of it is I approach writing novels in much the way that I read a book. I mean, I kind of liken it to writing is reading a book where the pages are blank and you have to fill them in and you have to tell the story. And as a reader, you want that satisfying experience of having, you know, you can't tie up all the ends, but you want some sort of a satisfying ending. So I'm trying to meet my expectations as a reader or as a moviegoer, because sometimes I see these books in my mind as films as well. I want to have the experience that the reader or the spectator has as a writer, because I don't always know where it's going and I don't want to be let down.
Chicago's had a complicated Holocaust history. You know, I think of the March in Skokie, and there's a Holocaust museum there, but there's been some anti-Semitic stuff floating around for a long time. Did that influence you in creating this?
Oh, not per se, other than I'm not sure Chicago is different from any other large community that has a large Jewish population that nevertheless is a minority within the city at large. When I was writing the book, I'm really just setting something in the territory that I grew up. So in as much as I grew up with the threat of neo-Nazi marches in Skokie, which was one suburb over, or neo-Nazi rallies in Marquette Park on the south side, which you referenced before, I mean, that is part of the backdrop I was growing up with. So in as much as that's where I come from and that's what I knew, yes, that's part of what figures into the story. I mean, that said, Chicago has had a very vibrant Jewish community, which has integrated pretty well into the fabric of the city itself. A lot of people have issues with our first Jewish mayor, Rahm Emanuel, but I think most of those issues are akin to his policies and his personality and his the language that he uses, as opposed to the fact that he's Jewish.
Yeah. Chicago is kind of a character in all of a lot of your books. You know, it just sort of emerges in a way. I love that sense of place, but also maybe because when you write about the 70s or 80s, you know, I remember them and I remember them in a different place, but there's a clarity to that. How do you capture those memories so clearly with the detail? Do you work at that or does it just flow?
I mean, I have what you might call a photographic memory, which doesn't mean that I get everything right, but I have very vivid memories of Chicago in the 1970s and 1980s. I remember what it smells like. I remember what the sounds were like on the L train. I remember what the old elevated train cars looked like. I remember the buses. I remember what was on each corner. Sometimes it turns out I'm wrong and I have to go back and fix it later. But mostly it's a matter of cutting out the detail later because there's way too much of it, as opposed to kind of sprinkling it in later. And the reason why Chicago is so vivid on the page, at least I hope, is because it's so vivid in my memory and vivid in my mind. So I could set these novels elsewhere. I mean, I've set a couple in Manhattan as well, where I live now.
Sure.
But, you know, that's where I come from, and that's what I remember, and that's... another person growing up in Chicago would have a very different memory of the place.
And of course.
More correct than I am, but...
I don't know. It feel. You know, the verisimilitude is terrific. I mean, it worked pretty well for Saul Bellow, so, you know, what the heck.
Yeah, but you know, if you go to Herzog, you know, I forget what it is, but there's like in the first chapter, he makes a mistake about Chicago. I forget what it is, and I should underline it. And I was like, wait, what?
Well, you know, go argue. But you're right. You know, sometimes things are real on the page that aren't actually, you know, real. I want to talk about what it means to be the executive editor for Culture at the Forward, which is kind of the national Jewish newspaper. Tell us a little bit about how that role evolved.
I've been at the Forward for about 8-9 years now. I started out editing the arts and culture section back when we had a print publication, and then we switched to a monthly magazine. I was editor of the monthly magazine, and then when we switched to digital, I became the executive editor of that. And that pretty much that means if you see anything on the page that's not a news story and it's not like an opinion piece, I'm responsible for it and you can blame me for it. So whether it's a piece I'm editing now about, what am I editing now? About a new album of excavated Yiddish songs, whether it's about an excavated synagogue from Vilna, whether it's a review of a show on HBO that features Jewish content, whether we're talking about the secret Jewish history of Olivia Newton-John, that's pretty much I'm to credit or blame for whatever that is.
So you must get a lot of kvetching and occasional kvels in your job.
What I get is a lot of email. And why didn't you cover this? Why did you cover that? Why do you have a critic who loved this thing that I hated? Why do you have a critic that hated this thing that I loved? Why are you talking about this flippant subject when this is a very serious religion and pursuit? Why aren't you doing more funny stuff? Jews are supposed to have a sense of humor. Yeah, I get, we get a lot of it.
The I want to come back to the book for a moment. You know, the cutting back and forth, the understanding that comes of the evolution of the terrible things that take place, of course, in the Diary of Anne Frank, they're always off stage, by the way. And then seeing them through the light of how America changes. It's now been, you know, some years since Trump was elected. We're in a kind of a weird, different period right now. Do you think that the I wouldn't say conclusions, but the direction of the novel would be different if you had followed it up to like now?
Oh, of course. I mean, and something that's very difficult to do is to write about recent past. Like if I'm writing about 1982, that feels fixed in my mind. There's specific dates, but I was writing about something that was only a year or two behind what I was experiencing. So I was still processing as I was writing. And no doubt if I was writing about something that was taking place now, these characters, I'm sure, would have different trajectories. I mean, I stop it at a particular moment where everyone is doing a specific thing. We know where they are in that moment. But, you know, our recent pasts are no more fixed than our distant past. And what the ending is just a moment frozen in time, and you freeze it in 2019, in 2022, it's going to be very different. A lot of, you know, people talk about whether something has a tragic ending, whether it has a happy ending, which is reductive, of course, but, you know, it all depends on where you stop it. And sometimes you like to store up with something where there's a moment of hope for someone, but, you know, that's ephemeral too. Or just as if you stop at a moment of tragedy, that's also ephemeral. It's just it's just where you decide to freeze your friend.
I want to say it's a great read, Cyclorama. Where can people go to find out more, Adam, about you, about your books, about your work?
You can go to Bloomsbury's website, bloomsbury.com. I mean, you know, there's more than enough information out there. If you go to your local independent bookseller, you know, I won't say no if someone wants to purchase the book on Amazon. That's fine, too. But, you know, I am partial to Book Culture in New York and the bookstore in Lenox, Massachusetts. And what's your bookstore out in Tucson?
Bookman's, actually, is a good place. Or Antigone Books. Either one. And they don't advertise on Too Jewish. I have no percentage on it, so...
Okay. But yeah, we'll send a shout out to them as well. But, you know, the book, I hope, speaks for itself in some way. I hope the story appeals. And I think even though it's set in a very specific time in a very specific place, my belief is that the more specific you are, the more universal you are, because people can kind of take that reality and graft it onto their own reality. So 1982, 2016-17, Chicago, but I think anyone can relate to it 30, 40 years later. You don't have to have grown up then.
No,
have to have lived in Chicago.
I think it's a great universal story, and it's a great read, like all of your books. Adam, thank you so much.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me, and wish you the best of luck with your show.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Danya Rotenberg, author of Repentance and Repair, Making Amends in an Unapologetic World. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for Shabbat and for the High Holy Days. You can come in person every Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and also available on our Facebook page. And the Jewish High Holy Days are coming up just 4 weeks from tonight. Join us in person or online. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for information on how to come to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and how to celebrate the new year with Beit Simcha. Our playout this morning comes, again, from the Orthodox folk rock group Zusia. It's Zochreinu L'chaim, Remember Us for Life, for the upcoming Jewish High Holy Days. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly for everyone of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.